Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Keeping the Chattahoochee, Reviving and Defending a Great Southern River, by Sally Sear Bethay, narrated by Rosemary Benson. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. Langston Hughes, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, 1925. Preface. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Mary Oliver. I grew up beside two small streams that converged behind my home on the outskirts of Atlanta, Georgia, in the 1950s and 1960s. These clear waterways, which flowed through the large wooded lots in our mid-20th century neighborhood, were full of minnows, crayfish, and snakes. As a young girl, I wondered where the water went when it left our yard. One summer, I recruited my sister and a friend to follow our unnamed stream through woods and neighbors' backyards, exploring the meandering watercourse with its gold-flecked rocks and rippling currents. Years later, I learned that my childhood stream, or creek, flows into Nancy Creek, then Peachtree Creek, and finally the Chattahoochee River. Like many children, I loved playing in the creek and falling asleep to the soothing sound of flowing water outside my bedroom window and the hooting owls in the trees, my pocket of nature. I was a city girl with a love of the natural world and a predilection for adventure, both of which have stayed with me all my life. On what was then a largely undeveloped island off the west coast of Florida, my family found a special place where we vacationed as I grew up. We collected shells on its beaches, visited the wildlife refuge that comprises a third of Sanibel Island, boated and fished with friends, and painted watercolors of coconut palms waving in the ocean breezes. We watched the ever-changing shoreline, altered through the seasons and years by wind, waves, and currents. We hunted fossil shells on the banks of the Caloosahatchee River, sifting through the sandy marl to find specimens that were millions of years old, yet still had shiny patinas. In the backwaters of mangrove swamps, we waded barefoot, at times in waist-deep water, consciously exploring the muddy bottom with our toes, seeking king's crown conches. A large climbable driftwood tree, polished by sand and wind, became an imaginary house with ocean views from every room, and a special driftwood key allowed entrance. My parents loved Sanibel's wild nature, its red mangrove forests, flocks of roseate spoonbills, and rare Junonia shells, and did what they could to help preserve it. At a young age, I learned the importance of advocating for the things you love, especially those that are voiceless. When planes flew low over the island's beaches during the post-war 1950s and early 1960s, spraying clouds of the insecticide DDT to kill mosquitoes, we ran outside, excited to see the old war bombers. We waved at the pilots, who were visible through the plane windows. The poisonous legacy of DDT and other chemical wonders was years from being revealed to the public by a courageous scientist and brilliant writer named Rachel Carson. Carson's book, Silent Spring, published in 1962, ignited fierce opposition from the chemical and agricultural industries and helped inspire today's environmental movement. A decade later, after being designated a probable human carcinogen, DDT was finally banned in the United States. However, it continues to contaminate ecosystems and can still be found in animal tissue. My mother survived 3 different cancers, including lymphoma, during her 94 years. In my mind's eye, I can still see and wonder about the effect of those planes and the white clouds of poison that they regularly spread across our island. Just as other aircraft spread DDT across croplands, forests, and gardens throughout America. During my college years, beginning in the late 1960s, I studied social justice issues, civil rights, poverty, and mental health. I also found time to camp and hike in the southern Appalachians with friends, strengthening both body and mind. Walking in nature and listening to its music has never failed to lift and renew my spirits, helping me find the truth in the common language of all living things. After college and back home, I looked for opportunities to meet people, further explore Georgia's natural beauty, and find ways to advocate for a healthy environment for all. In the mid-1970s, I attended my first meeting of the local chapter of the Sierra Club, the national organization established in 1892 by wilderness advocate and environmental philosopher John Muir. I recall my immediate affinity for the people I met there. They were friendly and passionate about fighting for rivers, forests, and coastline. The club's outings program offered easy access to wilderness areas, mountain ridges, barrier islands, and new acquaintances. I became a volunteer and club officer. I had found the circle of people who would become my friends and colleagues. One of the original river rats who helped lead what began as a ragtag movement to save the Chattahoochee River became my mentor and lifelong friend. Realizing that I needed to be better informed to become an effective advocate, I entered graduate school at Georgia Tech in 1978, supported by a scholarship for minorities. In those days, as a woman, I qualified. 2 years later, with a master's degree in environmental planning, I found a way to channel my budding conservation ethic into a career and honed my advocacy skills by working for the government and nonprofits. When my 2 sons were in middle and elementary school, and I was in my early 40s, I had the chance to become the first river keeper for the Upper Chattahoochee, a job that required creating a new nonprofit organization devoted to restoring and defending the hard-working waterway. Cutting through the heart of the Deep South, the Chattahoochee sustains nearly 5 million people with water to drink, opportunities to fish and swim, and places to renew their spirits. An essential part of that work is safeguarding the tributaries that flow into the Chattahoochee, including those streams behind my childhood home. For 2 decades, I worked with an eclectic range of people to restore our river, a demanding but gratifying task. We made real progress together, for which I am very grateful. I retired in 2014 and handed the reins of the organization to 2 trusted individuals who I had hired and worked side by side with for years. Retirement has been a time of reflection, a chance to finally slow down and more closely examine the world around me, especially the beauty and detail that I often rushed past while I was mothering and riverkeeping. I hoped to find intimacy in a local landscape where nature would be my teacher. I wanted to learn how to be more attentive, how to focus on the smaller things that we notice but do not really see every day of our lives. For more than a year, I regularly walked a path to the Chattahoochee that travels along a creek and through a forest of old-growth remnants. I learned how to be more attentive, how to adopt the pace of nature, as Ralph Waldo Emerson counseled. These walks through the seasons summoned memories and stories, from joyous and funny to frustrating and even alarming, about the people, adventures, challenges, and celebrations that filled my 2 decades of working to restore the Chattahoochee. Together, we helped give the river a voice. I wrote this book with 2 purposes in mind. First, to inspire you to find your own special place in nature, to magnify your sense of wonder and awe by focusing on those smaller things we rarely take note of, to learn how all of us, all living species, are truly and essentially connected. To quote poet Mary Oliver, we are a family of things. My hope is that my walks and observations, recounted at the beginning of each chapter, will draw you into the Chattahoochee watershed and open your eyes and heart to the wondrous variety of plants, animals, and people that inhabit our planet. The experience can be life-changing. My second purpose is to offer guidance and hope to those of you motivated to safeguard our natural resources, whether they be rivers, coastlines, wilderness, wildlife, or your neighborhood park. This means, of course, that you are working for the health and survival of all of us, our family. Each of my walks to the river prompted memories from my 2 decades as the riverkeeper for the Chattahoochee. These remembrances are captured here in stories that illustrate our effort to revive our neglected river. They include the strategies and challenges, the lessons learned, and the strengths we gained along the way, much of which could be summarized in 1 word, persistence. My journey to become the best possible environmental advocate, and to better understand myself, is woven through these stories. Like memories, these tales are not sequential in their telling. They move forward and backward in time. In this way, memories are unlike rivers. Chapter 1. Keeping Secretary Babbitt Dry. May 8, 2019. The sun shines not on us, but in us. The rivers flow not past us, but through us. John Muir. On a beautiful windy day in early May, I set forth in search of a locally beloved bamboo forest, a short distance from my home in Midtown Atlanta. Nearing the forest, I drive along a paved road lined with expensive homes, what was once a Native American trail. Where the pavement ends, a narrow dirt road continues to follow the ridge, leading me into the forested landscape of the East Palisades unit of the Chattahoochee River National Recreation Area. After parking my car in a designated area, I walk back across the access road, study a posted map, and turn onto a worn path. It leads downhill toward the river, passing, crossing, and sometimes winding above wooded ravines, rocky outcrops, and small streams that converge to become Cabin Creek, a tributary of the Chattahoochee River, whose waters I worked to protect for more than 2 decades. The clear water in the streams is noisy, gurgling as it falls over rocks, summoning memories of the streams behind my childhood home. The hardwood forest in the creek's ravine is filled with oaks, tulip poplars, sourwoods, magnolias, and beeches. A few spring wildflowers are still blooming in the woods, but most are long gone. I look forward to seeing the beauties that will undoubtedly emerge from the loamy, rich soil next spring before the dense tree canopy diminishes the sunlight reaching the ground. The stone ruins of an old cabin lie where the creek trail ends, at the Chattahoochee's shoreline, and intersects a second trail that winds along the river. The structure is believed to have been built in the 1930s or 1940s for hunting, drinking whiskey, and playing cards, according to a longtime park ranger. There's also a small stone bridge over the creek and a spring house upslope, but it will be weeks before I notice the bridge under the thick vegetation, and months before I find the spring house in the woods. The river is high, hurrying downstream through Devil's Racecourse shoals, then curving dramatically to the right past several islands, one called Charlie's Island for the founder of a local canoeing group. According to park ranger Jerry Hightower, there is some evidence that a bridge once crossed from the shoreline near the cabin to the island. It hasn't rained recently, so the high river must be the result of a torrent of water being released from Lake Lanier through Buford Dam, more than 40 miles upstream. The dam was constructed by the federal government in the 1950s to generate power, control floods, and provide enough water to float barges far downstream. Today, attempts to make use of the water behind the dam for other downstream needs, such as water supply, irrigation, and ecosystem health, have sparked endless conflict. "I can't see diving rock," a chunk of granite about 25 feet above the river from which local daredevils like to jump into the deep water, "but I know it's there, just a few hundred yards beyond the islands, across from the beach at Sandy Point." Seeing the Chattahoochee from this shoreline perspective for the very first time, rather than from my kayak in the river, I am astonished. I have stumbled on a place where water, rocks, sky, and trees create a majestic panorama. It's a startling new perspective on a scene I thought I already knew well. As I walk upstream along the river, mountain laurel shrubs, Kalmia latifolia, are blooming, flanked by doghobble bushes, Leucothoe fontanesiana. Laurel petals carpet the ground beneath them. I cross a stream on a dilapidated wooden bridge and pass beside tall rock outcrops that form an impenetrable slope, requiring the trail to negotiate a narrow stretch of land between the craggy palisades and the river. The bamboo forest, with its three-story bright green stalks, materializes before me. This non-native member of the grass family is one of the fastest-growing plants on Earth, able to quickly choke out natural vegetation. Although I am concerned about its impact on the park, I am still mesmerized by the tall silhouettes along the riverbank, dark stalks backlit by the sunlight flooding the Chattahoochee. 2 hours in the woods and at the river have passed like minutes. It's time to head home. I have made a decision. I have found a special place, a corner of nature that I will explore through the seasons. Switching between the past, present, and future, I think about the year-long adventure of walks that lie ahead. A memory of an incident that occurred just upstream of Diving Rock emerges from my early years as riverkeeper. In 1994, I began my duties as the first full-time riverkeeper for the upper half of the Chattahoochee River, from its damp beginnings at a spring in the North Georgia mountains to West Point Lake, a man-made reservoir, or lake, located midway down the most heavily used waterway in Georgia. 435 miles downstream of this spring, the Chattahoochee converges with the Flint River at the Georgia-Florida border and becomes the Apalachicola River. The Flint rises under the concrete runways of Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport and flows nearly 350 miles through rural farmland and forests to its meeting with the Chattahoochee. The mingled waters that drain from land in Georgia, Alabama, and Florida flow into Apalachicola Bay, one of the most biologically productive estuaries in the country, and then into the Gulf of Mexico. Working out of donated space in the basement of an office building near the river, Upper Chattahoochee Riverkeeper set about to keep watch over the river for people and wildlife. Nearly two decades after it was established, the organization expanded its mission to include the entire length of the Chattahoochee and its tributaries downstream to the Florida border, becoming Chattahoochee Riverkeeper. With co-founders Laura Turner Seidel and Rutherford Seidel, along with approval from the International Waterkeeper Alliance and a confidence-boosting seed grant from the Turner Foundation, Riverkeeper embarked on a journey to save the Chattahoochee. Plagued by chronic sewage spills, uncontrolled urban growth, dirty storm runoff, industrial toxins, trash, and overuse, the river was repeatedly named one of the most endangered rivers in the country. In addition to curbing pollution, Riverkeeper's work includes defending the environmental laws, policies, and budgets passed to safeguard waterways like the Chattahoochee, as well as protected places along its banks. The Chattahoochee River National Recreation Area, CRNRA, is one such protected place. This unit of the National Park System, established in 1978 by then-President Jimmy Carter, includes a 48-mile section of the Chattahoochee that flows through Metro Atlanta's northern suburbs to the western edge of the city. In 1995, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt visited the CRNRA. At the time, he was on a tour around the country to rally attention to an attempt by some federal legislators to close urban units of the National Park System, including our river park. The supposed rationale was to cut costs. When the proposal was finally dropped months later, Babbitt, an ardent supporter of national parks, said, "The House of Representatives appears to have finally heard the American people." The superintendent of the CRNRA invited me to join the group that would accompany Babbitt on a short canoe trip from Powers Island to Sandy Point, the beach across from Diving Rock. As media and onlookers assembled at the Powers Island put-in, the superintendent motioned to me. "Why don't you paddle with the secretary?" he said. I was not, and am not, an expert canoeist, much preferring a single kayak. I hesitated for a split second. I imagined flipping Bruce Babbitt in the river, with footage all over the evening news. Not for the last time in my river-keeping career, I decided to push myself into uncharted waters. Babbitt, who outweighed me by some 75 pounds, was helped into the bow. I took the stern. We floated downstream with the secretary holding his paddle in his lap. Eventually, we entered the fast-moving water of Devil's Race Course Shoals, approaching the hard right turn past the islands on our way to Sandy Point. Another canoe paddled toward ours. Inside it was a reporter with WSB-TV, a local television station known for its environmental reporting, along with his cameraman and the head of another nonprofit. They were all large men. Reaching toward us with an extended boom mic, the reporter attempted to carry on a conversation with the secretary, but he leaned too far out of his boat. Suddenly, his canoe flipped, in full view of the media and guests waiting on the beach at Sandy Point. Cameras on shore were rolling as I managed to steer our canoe past the mid-river mess, around the islands, and to shore, with Babbitt strangely silent in the bow. Were such events all in a day's work for the secretary, I wondered. The occupants of the other canoe were fine, just wet and embarrassed. I remember breathing a huge sigh of relief, not knowing then how many times over the next 20 years I would do other things far outside my comfort zone on behalf of the river. Some would end well, like this paddle trip, at least for the secretary and me. Others would be best described as character building. That night, several rival TV stations gave ample time to the canoe flipping episode. Chapter 2. Restoring a Farmer's Stream. May 15, 2019. A week later, as spring moves toward summer, the forest feels thicker and looks greener. My attention is drawn to the magnificent trees that grow in the rich soil on the north-facing slopes of the Cabin Creek Ravine. Huge tulip poplars, beeches, oaks, magnolias, sweet gums, pines, and more. The face that a slope represents to the sun plays a major role in its microclimate and the types of plants that colonize there. North-facing slopes, for example, are cooler and moister, with a greater diversity of plant species. It is doubtful that any farming or building has occurred in these woods in the past 100-plus years, according to local naturalist Catherine Kolb. The steep slopes, natural stream corridors, and protected remnants of the original forest are signs that the area was not easily accessible to humans. The soil and plant life have remained relatively untouched. No plowing, digging, scraping, compacting, or amending for at least four generations. Essential minerals and nutrients from decomposing animal and plant matter have enriched this soil, which is providing ecosystem services, like water filtration. I anticipate the river this time and hear it before my eyes can confirm that it is flowing fast and full. Again, it takes my breath away. As the trail turns, the understory opens, and I can see the silver-green water. The air at the river smells of freshly cut watermelon. A favorite wildflower, spiderwort, Tradescantia, is blooming in several places. Gorgeous pale pink flowers of the Carolina rhododendron, rhododendron minus, contrast with the shrub's dark green foliage. As I walk upriver on the trail, I find two trees leaning on and wrapping around each other in an arboreal embrace. A river birch and a maple are entwined in what must be a decades-long reliance on each other. They appear to be healthy trees that have found stability by settling into each other for balance and support, an angle of repose. It is a busy day on the trail. A couple carries a deflated raft and pump from a downstream parking area. They tell me they're hiking to the upper end of the river trail, where they plan to inflate the small raft and float back down to their car. Two young men carry climbing gear to scale the rock outcrops. There are trail runners, and I can see more rafts on the far side of the river. I pick up as much shoreline trash as I can carry in my arms and pockets, making a mental note to bring bags next time. Small pieces of styrofoam dominate, along with plastic wrappers, a few plastic bottles, and other detritus. Their origins were likely upstream lawns, roads, and parking lots. In the dappled light of the forest, I watch the river flow past, and then head back uphill, thinking about the thin, fragile layer of organic and inorganic material upon which all life depends, soil. A small word for such a tremendous gift. Several years ago, I joined Catherine Kolb to learn about soils and remnant old-growth forests in Atlanta. We explored the hardwoods on a steep slope in the West Palisades unit of the Chattahoochee River National Recreation Area, across the river from Cabin Creek. Catherine explained that Atlanta is unique among major cities in the country for the number of large wooded areas with old trees and undisturbed soils that build biologically diverse habitats. After the Civil War, much of the metro region stayed in a depressed and rural condition for many decades. Atlanta's expansion did not begin in earnest until the 1960s. This delay allowed pockets of the original forests in our area to survive, including those in the national park, whose lands were protected with federal ownership beginning a decade later. Soil is full of life. This upper layer of earth provides habitat for billions of microorganisms that absorb dissolved organic material, recycling matter and nutrients through the process of decomposition. The organisms that promote the growth and life cycles of native species include fungi, bacteria, protozoa, microarthropods, and nematodes, collectively known as a soil microbiome. Stability comes from such diversity. However, these organisms can be easily disturbed.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?